Hello and welcome from me, Jenny Devitt, to another edition of Countryside Matters. It's a rare thing in this country, isn't it, to hear people say they're happy to see rain, but we are. Don't worry, we'll soon start moaning about grey skies. The drought has been severe and affected everything in countryside and garden. We'll hear from an understandably gloomy George Hosford about the harvest. And although Nick Mann of Habitat Aid is not exactly optimistic about how our trees, especially newly planted ones, will have coped, Mike Burks of the Gardens Group takes a cheerful approach to helping our gardens weather the dry. And to end on a positive note, Sherborne resident and former broadcaster Neil Walker is determined to help nature in the town in any way he can through an umbrella group called Wild Sherborne. Over the last few months, all the fields out there have been turning more and more brown, and anyone with a garden has watched it looking increasingly sorry for itself. There's been plenty of talk as to whether we should rethink what we grow. A good port of call, of course, for gardening advice is Mike Burks of the Gardens Group. I spoke to Mike shortly before the weather finally broke and the first rain for nearly 6 months started to fall.
It's almost as I can't remember what rain is like. And in fact, last week I was at Wisley, at RHS Wisley, and there was a thunderstorm, and the joy of getting soaked was quite extraordinary. And actually the smell from the soil as a result of that bit of rain was just joyous, really. But it didn't last very long, and it didn't happen in Sherborne, so that was a bit sad.
So you must have felt a bit the way that people on the Indian subcontinent and elsewhere with before the monsoon, you know, when they can't wait for the end of the dry and down come the rains.
Yeah.
And everybody dances around, getting soaked to the skin.
Yeah, absolutely. And that for us is, we're so looking forward to that. And I'm in my own garden looking forward to it, with the lawn looking very parched. But, you know, with a bit of rain, that will come back and will recover very happily. But I'm just so pleased to have plants in pots on my patio, just keeping me inspired and keeping me happy as a result of them doing well. And some of my established plants, the shrubs and trees that Louise and I have got in the garden, are looking good and happy. Although one or two things, of course, bigger trees are going into autumn early. The good news is that they're under control because they're losing leaves, which means that they're, as a generalisation, but they're under control of the situation, so they're deciding to drop their leaves now. Whereas if you've got a plant which is holding on to its leaves and looking upset, then it's sort of lost control of the situation. But definitely looking forward to some decent rain coming.
Mm. So there's an increasing amount of talk, Mike, isn't there, about how we should perhaps be rethinking our gardens and what we plant in them.
Yes, indeed, yeah. But what do you aim that towards? Because this summer, obviously, hot and very dry. Last summer, actually, surprisingly very warm, but incredibly wet. So which of those are you aiming for? And what would be the prediction for next summer? Which of those is it going to be? It will be an extreme, I think, because that's the way things are now. But it might be somewhere in between the two, which would be perfect. So I think we can't predict what the weather conditions are going to be like. So therefore, we have to do other things in order to make sure that we carry on gardening successfully, which, of course, is so important for us, you know, in terms of our mental health and our physical health, but also important for the environment that we do keep on gardening.
So what would you advocate? I know your mantra, or one of your mantras, is mulch, mulch, mulch.
Yes, yeah. So two things, really. First of all is to look after the soil as much as we possibly can. So if the soil is kept in good health, then the nutrients, more importantly the water that the plants need, will be available, but also will be more water available, because if we think of the soil as its own biome, as its own environment that is alive, then it's full of microorganisms, beneficial bacteria, but especially mycorrhizal fungi. Now, these are the fungi that live naturally in soils, that attach themselves to plant roots and go off much further into the soil and much further down into the soil to gather water and nutrients, and then bring it back to the plant in exchange for a mouthful of sugar that the plant is generating. So it's a symbiotic relationship there. So if we keep the soil alive and happy and healthy, then you'll find that actually plants can survive a whole lot better, no matter what happens in terms of the weather or the climate. So they're in better shape. And so what I'm talking about there in terms of keeping the soil healthy is mulching. That's a really important thing. So mulching will keep the moisture in.
And it just so happens that you have bags of mulch here.
We do, yes,
for
yes.
Sale.
Oh, it's for sale. How about that? Free delivery too. But it also be really important. So when we do get the rain, it'll come in vast quantities very quickly. So what we'll find is that it won't be absorbed by the soil straight away, but where it hits the soil, it will damage it. But having a layer of mulch on top, what you get is the rain hitting the mulch, and so then seeping down gently into the soil, and will be absorbed by the soil a whole lot better. And then as that mulch gets broken down and gets dragged into the soil, so it'll be keeping the soil structure healthy, and also by feeding the bacteria and the mycorrhizae fungi in the soil, keeping the whole thing a very healthy biome. So mulching, really important. Feeding as well, but try and use organic fertilizers as much as possible. So things like seaweed is perfect. So inorganic fertilizers tend to feed the plant, whereas the organic fertilizers will feed the whole biome, feed eventually, and then of course feeding the plant as well. And then the other thing is to choose plants which are right for your particular situation. So what I mean by that is that if you've got a hot, dry, south-facing garden, then choose plants that will cope very happily with that situation. So a lot of silverleaf plants like lavenders and rosemary and convolvulus love that sort of situation, so choose those. But if you've got a wet, heavy clay, north-facing garden, they will struggle, avoid them in that situation. And then the same is true of the pH of the soil. So if you've got an alkaline soil, as most of us have in this area, then don't try and grow azaleas, rhododendrons, camellias in there. Just choose plants which will cope with the pH of your soil as well.
You mentioned that the rain will hit in the ground could damage the soil. Now, is that do you mean by that if it's heavy rain, it will actually land with a thud and compact the soil?
Well, physically, it's the physical nature as you're describing, not necessarily compacting the soil, but just damaging the top surface, which is the best quality, and then washing it away,
breaking it up and moving it away,
which of course in monsoon areas of the world that's what happens. But also, if you imagine, you know, when we have the maize harvest in the autumn in the UK, and if it's wet, then you absolutely know that's going on, because the roads around the fields where the farmers are harvesting are just full of topsoil. Their best quality soil is washing out of the field on the tractor wheels, or even as the rain floods those fields.
And benefiting people further downriver.
Well, maybe, yes, yeah, yeah.
But hopefully, rather than washing out to sea.
Yes, indeed. So this is why, with modern agriculture now, they're starting to leave debris in the soil, not cultivate, and that's all part of the same thing, is so that actually protecting the soil from the physical battering that you get with the sort of rain that we tend to get these days.
Tell me, Mike, would it help also to think of putting in plants which are very deep rooted?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be another good choice. But you finding things that do well. So have a look around. If you're new to an area, have a look around in neighbouring gardens to see what's growing well. Talk to your neighbours who have been gardening for a long time and say, what does well here? Join your local gardening club, and they will have lots of people who will say, try this, but I would avoid that. And also come and speak to our experts in the garden centres as well. But choosing plants that generally do well for you, and that doesn't mean boring plants. But sometimes when people are looking for unusual plants, well, that's fine, but quite often they're unusual for a number of reasons. One could be that they're difficult to propagate.
which or is just very temperamental
or very temperamental
challenging
so
to grow.
Therefore then from an environmental point of view, you know, we need to, it's important to have the diversity of plants, but if it struggles in your garden then with, you know, difficult climate conditions and difficult weather conditions, then it'll be the first to suffer. So I would suggest choose things which do well in your garden, choose things which are right for your area, and you know, you'll tend to have success and your garden will keep looking in good shape.
Alternatively, of course, Mike, you could just let the wild plants, otherwise known as weeds, grow. one of the things that really constantly surprises me when I go out walking my dog is to see things like chamomile and all sorts of other plants absolutely flourishing, looking green, healthy.
Yeah.
These, you know, these things we call weeds just popping up through the cracks. And
well, of course,
with
weed,
no sign of suffering from drought at all.
No, indeed. And that's because, you know, they're deeper rooted. They're finding their sort. So if you look at lawns where it's not just grass, then it's the non-grass species that are still green because they're going a whole lot deeper into the soil and finding moisture. And also they might be doing better because there's no competition from grass at the moment, because, you know, the grass is just shallower roots and that will then not be finding moisture. And so those other plants can thrive. And by the way, weeds is starting to become an outdated term.
I'm delighted to hear it.
Yeah, so it's
that's why I said native or wild plants.
Yes, that's right. So that was interesting at when we were at Wisley last week. So we had a tour of the entomology department and talking to the scientists there, and one of our party challenged them as to who was it who said that we need to start loving slugs, which of course is a very controversial thing.
I think we'll pass right over slugs at the moment.
Yeah, they're not doing very well at the moment because it's just too dry for them.
Can't say I'm sorry.
But no, but this is the same thing of, you know, of where, well, a weed of course is any plant in the wrong place, but actually, you know, I think there's some wonderful wild plants that we can incorporate and allow to grow in our gardens and have, you know, bits of the garden which are dedicated to becoming wild, or as wildlife gardeners call it, no-go areas. And you might say, well, the whole of my garden's like that, but
I think at the moment mine pretty much is.
Yeah, but those are great habitats for, you know, the beneficial insects and small mammals and reptiles, you know, frogs, toads, and things like slow worms and grass snakes will find a nice space to live. And whilst you're not around, they're in your garden eating up the pests. And so, you know, and that again is all part of dealing with climate change, is to work as much as we can with nature, encouraging nature, and that will that's definitely something we should be working towards.
Well, last year I discovered to my delight that underneath some willow herb I found the caterpillar of a small elephant hawk moth, since which time I thought, well, I better leave that willow herb alone. But it is happily colonising the rest of the garden.
Superb. Isn't that wonderful? And what a wonderful wonderful find that is. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a lovely thing. And it's, you know, what that I say to people, when you're gardening for wildlife, there's an extra dimension. And the delight you get in finding something like that appearing is just wonderful. And, you know, it's just shows how wildlife gardening can be just fabulous fun.
Mike Burks, Managing Director of the Gardens Group. And of course, since we recorded that interview, we have had some very, very welcome rain. Sadly, it's come rather too late to help our farmers' crops swell and flourish. And reports from up and down the country show that yields are down. I turned to my favourite Dorset farmer, George Hosford, to find out what the picture is for him near Blandford. When I said to George that I'd read that the UK harvest was on course for being a new record low, according to the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board, his answer surprised me.
Well, it's not a new record low. It'd take an awful lot to get as low as 2012.
2012? Why was 2012 so bad?
Oh, well, it was the most miserable, wet, cloudy summer we possibly ever saw.
Worse than last year?
Oh, yes. I'm just going to try and get my program. Here we are, yields. Yields, I've got umpteen records, umpteen years of records.
This is going to be your legacy to your children, is it? All these years of records,
yes,
of your harvest.
Costing, so it's just fine.
But very valuable information.
It is. Right, if we just look at wheat yields. Hang on, let's get to the yield page. Right, I've got the one that goes back to 1994 now. So, 1989. Okay, well, so this year we harvested just shy of 8 tonnes a hectare. First, we're talking about first wheat. So wheat's grown after a break. Last year we had 8.6 tonnes a hectare. The last time we broached the 10-tonne mark was in 2020, where we made 11.5 tonnes a hectare, which was our...
And yet I understood, George, that 2020 was a bad year.
Not for us.
Generally speaking, in the UK.
Not you.
Not for you.
No. Now, prices, I can't remember prices without going back in the records. So odd years we've made it to 11, quite a number of years we've made it to 10 tonnes, but we were, 2012, didn't I? 6.64 tonnes in 2012 compared to our sort of long-running average for a long time was not far short of 10 tonnes a hectare. That's dipped rather, partially because we've changed our style of farming and we're not using as much fertiliser and chemical as we used to be because we're trying to find a more soil-friendly balance with lower inputs, slightly lower outputs, to end up with a similar margin.
And tell me again, George, so what was this year's harvest?
7.9.
So better than 2012?
Yes, significantly better than 2012. Let's just check if there's any other years in between that were as low as that. No, 2012 was the previous most terrible, and 2007 was just over 7 tonnes a hectare. But running right back to 1992, nothing else dipped below 8 tonnes a hectare. Goodness, that's 30 years, more than 30 years, 33 years. In only 3 years have we dipped below 8 tonnes a hectare. So, yes, I suppose it is pretty terrible. But what we've got this year, which is far more consequential, is terrible grain prices. Whereas in 2012, the grain price did shoot up because there was a big drought and a big shortage across many parts of the world. But having said that, I remember having sold quite a bit before harvest at lower prices. The prices only went up after we'd sold more than half of the crop. And with only a 6.6 ton crop, when hopefully you were banking on maybe 9, you'd sold an even higher proportion than you thought you had. So we weren't able to take advantage of the high prices, if you see what I mean.
But George, if your yield was down this year, and presumably other people's down as well, how come, which would, yes, mean that the grain is in short supply or shorter supply, how come the price is down?
Because we're much more vulnerable to world markets now than we were then. Prices have been depressed for many months. I've sold very little. In fact, I've sold no wheat for at least 3 months.
So this is competition from imported grain, you mean?
There's a number of aspects to it. Yes, potential conflict from imported grain. There's quite a carryover from the previous harvest as well, because this time last year, or even earlier than this, before harvest last year, because of the very, very wet weather, it was perceived by many buyers, like millers particularly, people who are going to mill the wheat and sell it to bakers, they decided that there wasn't a chance of there being enough good quality grain grown in Britain. So they imported quite a lot of grain even before we'd harvested our harvest. And our harvest turned out to be not quite as bad as people had thought. The upshot is that prices have been relatively depressed since then. That has continued, and we've carried over grain, which wasn't sold for one reason or another, wasn't sold by farmers or wasn't sold by merchants who had already bought it. So we've ended up with a bit of a glut on the market at the beginning of the new season, you know, immediately following harvest, which depresses prices. Not only that, the Americans in their wisdom have just found another 25 million tons of maize, or corn as they call it, which is a feed grain which weighs heavily on the world markets, which has put an enormous amount of pressure on world markets as well, if you follow me. Now, how they've come up with that, it was only pre-harvest estimates, but every month the American Department for Agriculture publish estimates of likely grain yields or actual grain yields from around the world to end up with a sort of a world supply-demand balance. And the pressure has, it's been very bearish. The pressure has been huge on grain prices. So we've only watched grain prices go downwards through harvest. And if I look back through the texts I get daily about what the grain market's doing, it's just nothing but depressing. 50p down one day, £2 down another day. And we're now in the mid to low 160s, £160 a tonne.
Well, perhaps, George, we ought to turn our attention to something else then that hopefully might be marginally less depressing. I have seen one report that says that oilseed rape that was planted late last year, like last September, has proved successful this summer in Dorset.
A lot of people have done a lot better with rape than they have done for many years, and nobody can put their finger quite on it. It's a bit of a lottery as to whether you go late or early. We've tended to go earlier for the last few years. We've not yet given up growing rape. Many people gave up growing rape, which is why our national rape harvest now is so low that we have to import a huge proportion of the rape seed we need to provide the oil that we need for our appetite in the markets in the UK. So I think I did have the figures on the tip of my tongue. I think generally we have an appetite for about 2 million tonnes of rapeseed every year in the UK, and we were only expected to produce about 700,000 tonnes. That might be a bit higher, so say 800,000 tonnes. But the balance will have to be imported. And I know I've said this to you before on one of these interviews, that the balance that has to be imported will undoubtedly have been grown using techniques and chemical products that we are not allowed to use.
Yes.
So our hands are tied behind our back. We're still expected to compete with foreign produced rapeseed, not to mention pig meat and eggs.
Yes, but not on a level playing field then. So
It's so far from a level playing field, it's not true. Now, then you have to remember that the rest of Europe is still getting the full basic payment through the Common Agricultural Policy. The Tories promised us a wind down of the basic payment over 7 years following Brexit. Labour, in their wisdom, decided last autumn to cut off the last 3 years of this wind down, and so this year we've gone to practically nothing.
And you no longer have the sustainable farming incentive payments.
And we don't have the sustainable farming incentive to apply for either, and we don't know when or whether that's going to come back. We're pretty brassed off, Jenny, as you can probably tell.
Yeah, so not a lot of support from the UK government for UK farmers.
No. It's reducing, seriously reducing. And if you interviewed land-owning farmers, whereas you may remember I'm not a land-owning farmer, they would give you a lot of grief about inheritance tax as well, where the government have got it hugely wrong, but I am not supporting many of my fellow farmers, landowner friends.
I know you don't. Let's move away from that one then, shall we, George? and just finish on about soils, because there are calls, aren't there, for more support to invest in healthier soils and other green farming measures to boost resilience against climate change. And I know you plant cover crops, and you say that that goes some way to sorting that problem out.
Yes. Well, it's supposed to, yes, whether we've seen any difference yet. When our soils are all, you know, since harvest, our stubble fields have sat there baking in the sun, which is not good for the livestock in the soil at all. One of the rules of regenerative farming is that you should keep the soil covered at all times. Well, how do you do that when you have a 3-month drought, 4-month drought, maybe 5-month drought? I mean, it's desperate. We've never known such a long dry period, and the ground is like concrete. We've managed to scratch some cover crop seeds into the soils where we've got a little bit of tilth, our chalkier soils where it's more friable, but our clay soils are absolutely like concrete, and all they do is wear out the steel on your and machinery and burn diesel, where we worry that if you can't put the seeds at least partially into the soil, it'll get eaten by predators, birds or insects or whoever,
so
before it's had a chance to wet up when eventually we get some rain and actually germinate. So some we've sown and managed to get it into the ground just a little bit, but desperately needs, it won't germinate till we've had some rain. So you've got all these things, and every day, we all, like always, farmers will moan about the weather. You know, we've always had to complain about the weather, and you'd think that that's perhaps one of the reasons why farming has been considered worthwhile, because how are you going to guarantee your food supply? You've got to give your farmers the incentive to get out of bed in the morning and bother to try to grow food. But very shortly, we're going to be in a position where there'll be no money made from food production, and we'll give up. We will grow flowers, or we will do nothing, or we will try and get solar panels on our land or something like that. And the food will come from God knows where, with God knows what used to produce it. I'm sounding pretty gloomy and quite cross, because I am.
Yes, you're angry, just as many, many farmers are. But just finally, George, please gaze into your crystal ball and tell me what changes farmers should be making come this autumn, if the rains come.
Well, it's very hard to persuade one's fellow farmers to go with the environmental schemes, because we, you know, everybody can talk about this healthier soils, but if we're going to do short-term changes which are actually going to give us short-term drops in yield, most farmers are going to tell you to go and whistle, because they're not going to take that risk. And without pretty cast-iron guarantees of compensation for farming with a prospect of lower yields, i.e. through the SFI, which was supposed to have been open all the time to all farmers, then you aren't going to get any of this la-di-da healthier soil stuff, I'm afraid. And we're still trying to do it because we passionately believe it's the right thing. And if we can manage to incorporate more organic matter in our soils, we believe that it makes us more our soils more tolerant of heavy rain periods, because they can soak up more soil. And it will also make us more tolerant of droughts, because the organic matter helps to store more moisture in the soil. But when you get a drought as extreme as this, I mean, nothing is going to grow in our soils until we've had rain, however much organic matter we've got, because it's still all gone. The drought has been so severe. So that's what people need to get real about, you know, all the wild farmed and what have you, which we're trying to do. Unless there's some proper money attached, it's not going to happen.
You know, might there be, George, if we're going to get into this pattern of protracted droughts, because as you said, it's been it'll be coming up for pretty nearly 6 months soon. If we're going to get into the state in this country where our livestock does not have its usual lovely verdant green fields to graze, should we perhaps be looking at cattle, breeds of cattle that you find, for instance, in Africa? In other words, breeds that are used to grazing off something that looks, grazing off stuff that looks as if it's got no nutritious value whatsoever.
Yeah, if we're going to have to, you know, if we're going to see an end to the reliable maritime climate that we've enjoyed in this country on the western end of Europe for ever, thousands and thousands of years, then massive changes will have to happen. Well, I'm not really into navel gazing, because don't forget, in March, which was only 6 months ago, we didn't know at the time, but the tail end of an 18-month utter deluging, and we thought it's never, ever going to stop raining.
George Hosford, and I've never yet heard him be quite so pessimistic about prospects for UK agriculture. I recorded that interview, as you probably guessed, before the rains returned. Back in the late spring this year, the Woodland Trust published its report on the status of Britain's trees and woodlands. The report stated that they're not in as good a shape as they should be. Its message was taken up by Nick Mann of Habitat Aid, a very enterprising enterprise not far from Stourhead. He and his team sell native wild flowers, seeds, hedgerow plants and trees. And it was about trees that I spoke to Nick recently. A few weeks back, he'd written a blog inspired by that Woodland Trust report, and he referred to Groundhog Day, so I wondered why he'd used that term.
This has been a long-running saga. We hear an awful lot about the lack of woodland cover in the UK and the need for tree planting. We hear very little about the state of our existing woodlands, which is very poor. I often think we would be better advised to actually sort that out before we go off and plant thousands of new plants, which will, in a lot of cases, conk out anyway. And there are some it's very frustrating, because there are some very basic things that we can do to improve the state of our existing woodland. It's just that They don't seem to be very well funded, and they don't get the kind of political headlines which tree planting does.
Of course, yes, I suppose it's, you could say it's actually comes across as being a bit more glamorous to be planting new trees. People think they're being doing something really positive and beneficial for the environment, don't they?
Absolutely, and so that there is a degree of greenwash that goes on as well. With corporates going off and doing planting days, and obviously there are lots of companies which are planting trees, aren't they? For if you buy a flight to Barbados, whatever it might be, you've got offsets being offered by people, and of course you've got easy targets for the government to start talking about as well in terms of electioneering. So it's an easy win for people, and obviously also very visible. You can post nice pictures of your volunteers planting thousands of trees, often actually in the wrong places as well, which is another story. But culling grey squirrels and shooting deer is not quite as good for corporate image.
No, we'll come to that one in a moment. I mean, you talk about trees being wrong trees in the wrong place, where it should be a more careful selection of species. Of course, I understand it's been known for quite some time that it would be far better to let a woodland regenerate naturally, which means getting rid of the creatures that like to eat trees.
Mm. Exactly. So natural regeneration is absolutely the easiest and probably best way to get new woodland going. There is a caveat to that, which is that in a lot of places, the existing seed bank and local plants are so degraded that you can end up with a rather limited woodland in terms of the species that there are there.
Is that any more limited, Nick, though, than creating a new plantation of young trees?
That's a good point. We always try and get as many different species into the woodland schemes that we're involved in as possible. But what tends to happen is that landscape architects don't specify some of the more difficult to grow species or some of the more unusual species. So there are, for example, trees like, what's a good example? Osorbus torminalis, the wild service tree. It's very difficult to grow from seed.
You don't see many of those, do you? No.
You really don't. And it's very difficult to grow from seed. And that's why you don't. It's nothing to do with the appropriateness of the tree. It's that you very rarely see it grown by nurseries because it's just not commercial for them. The yields they get on it are so very poor.
Nick, on the subject of the service tree, which I think is a beautiful tree, my understanding is that it's been given that common name because over the centuries it was very serviceable. It was very useful. You could use every single part of that tree.
Oh, is that right? Oh, I didn't know that. It has a lot of common names, actually. It's a lovely old tree with a lot of history, very helpful for biodiversity, actually. But we don't see it planted very much at all, which is a great shame. And a good example of the sort of thing that we're talking about. So yeah, natural regen generally, is the way to go. But as you say, it's becoming more and more problematic with these pests that there are about, and consequently, we're seeing a lot of planting as a substitute. But even those planted schemes are vulnerable to the kind of issues that naturally regenerating plants would be too.
So, Nick, are we in danger of reducing the variety of species by just having a limited number of different tree species that that get grant funding to be planted in under new schemes?
Yes, and you also get into a bit of a vicious circle, because the fewer of these more rarer trees there are out there, the less likely they are to reappear naturally as well, right? All this, of course, is exacerbated by the impact of climate change as well. You know, there are clearly species which are already struggling in the landscape, and they will disappear too.
What species have you got in mind in particular there?
Anything obviously that's associated with wetland, so that would be willow, for example, or alder. There are a number of species which have relatively shallow root systems, which suffer in drought. I'm thinking particularly beech, which had a terrible time after the 76 drought. And I think you could put blackthorn in the same category as well. I mean, blackthorn's a freely suckering species, and its root systems seem to be quite shallow. So if you look about in the hedge lines, you'll see it looking very distressed now. I mean, in the past, when you've had an event, a single event like that drought in 76, the species affected have recovered after a little while. But of course, this time round, it's different. The other issue, of course, is that we're not just talking about drought. We're talking about those warmer, wetter winters. And it's the combination of the two things that are really most injurious to trees.
I'm thinking of, you know, these plantations of poplars, because poplar, as we know, is a very thirsty tree and traditionally been planted in areas to soak up the water. So perhaps we should discourage the planting of poplars.
Well, that's absolutely so. Yeah. And in fact, there are some quite thirsty trees which are being planted as because they're very effective carbon sinks. They're very effective absorbing carbon. They take a lot of water too. Some ornamentals that are grown for that sort of thing. And you see eucalyptus, for example, grown quite widely, or has been grown quite widely, which is not terribly helpful too.
Now, you referred into that in that same blog, Nick, to the Disneyfication of nature. Such a good term, that.
I must have been feeling cross. Yeah.
and this is a problem, really, when it comes to the way that most of us view squirrels and deer, isn't it? Because those are the two major enemies of young trees and existing woodland, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, we've had this tendency to anthropomorphize nature. I don't know when it started, but you know, I suppose it's a symptom of us being rather removed from it. But it's really incredibly unhelpful. And if you talk to anybody involved in forestry, they're you know, it's not exactly a secret that these two species in particular are the major problem. It's just we seem to be so unwilling to do anything about it. I mean, I know estate managers who are culling literally thousands of grey squirrels every year. And they are absolutely prolific. We think also that deer numbers the records are very difficult to analyse, but we think that they're probably at all-time highs now. There was some culling at sort of local level of deer. That was rather put on the back foot over COVID. And the population's kind of exploded around that period. So the problem's got even worse.
Well, I must say, Nick, a few months back I was talking to somebody and we were kind of bemoaning the fact that it's a little difficult to decide if you're a carnivore, if you like your red or white meat, what one can eat, because we all know that mass-produced chickens are very bad for watercourses and for trees. And, of course, then we know that livestock farming, cattle and sheep, is also quite detrimental to the environment. And she said to me, eat venison.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because, she said, it's much better for you. It's lean and it's plentiful. But it's getting over this hurdle, isn't it, of thinking of, oh dear, little Bambis, we can't shoot them.
Yeah. But it's so bizarre that we don't have any qualms at all about beef cattle. And we do about, you know, we do about eating deer. It's incredibly frustrating. But demonstrably, we do. And you know, we really do need to get our heads around this.
So I mean, what can, aside from just quietly going out and doing something on their own land, what can landowners do to try and control these numbers? Not a lot.
I don't think it's very much. I mean, there've been various efforts at sort of sterilising squirrels and all that sort of thing. It doesn't seem to have helped in any way. All we can do really is cull them. I mean, I'm hesitating here because this gets us into another area, which is species reintroduction. One of the reasons why we've got this issue is because we don't have a properly functioning ecosystem. So you know, these animals don't have predators really. So you know, we've taken wolves and lynx and that sort of thing out of the landscape. So there's nothing really that will take a young deer out there in the broader landscape in the UK. So the argument goes, well, let's reintroduce them. That's an entirely different kettle of fish. I think in it broadly speaking, in a landscape like the UK, I don't think you can reintroduce wolves. You may possibly be able to reintroduce lynx, I think, but there'd be a tremendous hoo-ha, and I think it would be difficult to do it on a large scale. Predators for the greys, are easier because they have to be as big, obviously. And it turns out grey squirrels are rather heavier than reds, so they're easier for a couple of species like pine martens to predate. That's a possible answer, I suppose.
It's a difficult one. Maybe what we need is a major public awareness campaign and try and hard and challenging as it would be to change the public perception of those two cute looking, fluffy, furry species.
Yeah, I mean, people call I've heard people refer to grey squirrels as tree rats. Maybe that's the way forward. One's got to try and start thinking of them as a kind of rat. I don't know. I always feel rather sorry for rats as being singled out for special treatment.
I bet, Nick, if squirrels didn't have those fluffy tails, people, and if they had a tail like a rat, people would view them differently.
I think they may.
Anyway, let's just finish on this issue of new trees. Of course, the great thing is you stick them in the ground, but then you've got to look after them. I mean, one of the statistics was that I read was that something like 30% of trees planted along roadsides just don't make it. Well, nobody's ever going to go there to water or look after them, are they?
Well, 30% and the rest. Yeah, now this is tricky. There are a number of things that we can do about this. It's a particular bugbear, actually. The first, the most obvious thing is that typically landscape architects will specify plants that are too big. The bigger the plant you're sticking in the ground, the more vulnerable it's going to be while it establishes. It'll establish much more slowly. Some species are very difficult to get going above a certain size. I'm thinking particularly the oaks. And the failure rates for anything larger than a kind of standard 60-90 hedge whip are horrendous. And they're just going to get even worse. I mean, there's no point putting an oak tree in the ground that's a metre and a half tall. It's just going to die in the current climate without a great deal of TLC, which of course the majority of these plants aren't getting. They're not getting any help at all. Combination of things that we can do. I don't think we should obviously give up on it, but it's very problematic.
Nick Mann of Habitat Aid, and he's so right. We really shouldn't give up on it, should we? And now to end with something very encouraging, a new wildlife and nature recovery initiative in Sherborne. Neil Walker and his wife moved to the town some 6 years ago. They've always been keen on wildlife, and now Neil has taken his interest one big step further and decided that it would be good to get all the different conservation and wildlife groups in and around the town to interact more under an initiative called Wild Sherborne. When I met Neil a few days ago, the first obvious question to ask him was what had prompted his idea for Wild Sherborne.
I have to say it goes back 40 years. So long before I even knew Sherborne existed, because I was living in Norfolk at the time in a rural environment. And the trouble with living where I was in the depths of Norfolk was that bit of Norfolk had lost most of its wildlife and most of its countryside, because the EU happily gave farmers loads and loads of money to tear up the trees, tear up the hedgerows, turn small fields into large fields, and pretty much destroy the countryside. And it made me very unhappy because I wanted to walk in the countryside and I couldn't.
And did you see the change during the time that you were there?
No, that was as well, to some extent, yes. I mean, they wanted to drain what was called the Halvergate Marshes, which was not where I was living, but it was in Norfolk. And again, there was a massive campaign to stop that from being drained because, it was a fantastic wetland. So again, there were grants available to do it. So it was, if you like, it was governments and the EU happily bunging money towards farmers. And I don't blame them, they're trying to make a living. And I discovered at that particular time that you could actually get the wildlife to come to you. My son was very young, but very keen on wildlife, birds in particular. But he said, "Can we have a pond in the garden?" So one day we dug a blooming great pond, and Within a week, we had great crested newts in the pond. Within the year, we had snipe visiting our pond. And that kind of told me the story that if you want the wildlife and you live in an area where they're not being looked after particularly well, you can make them come to you. And they're happy to come to you because where else are they going to go? And that was the seed, if you like, for wild sherborne, because I face a very similar situation here where I live, on the edge of the countryside. I look out on a beautiful piece of hillside. 6 years ago when I came here, I heard cuckoos. I don't anymore. I used to see hare. I don't anymore. I used to watch the foxes. I don't anymore. These are all disappearing in front of our eyes, and we have to do something about it.
I have heard, though, I just heard yesterday that over closer to where I live, which is just over the border in Somerset, the hares are increasing.
Ah.
So maybe they've moved from you here in Sherborne and they're heading over into Somerset.
Maybe it is. I'm not suggesting that they would move into people's gardens, but my idea for wild Sherborne is to invite the wildlife to come to us if that's what they want to do. And I think they do want to do that, because here I've created two wildlife meadows, very small wildlife meadows. You can walk across them in about 10 seconds. But this year I've had 19 species of butterflies in my garden. 19. That's better than I can see in a mile and a half of walking in the countryside outside my door.
It has been a good summer. Everybody says it has been a good summer for butterflies, hasn't it? And the insects have increased in number.
They have, yes. But we're now hitting a point where the nectar is disappearing because of the drought. So again, we're down to global warming. And what do we do to counteract the effects of global warming? Well, you know, they can't find that nectar in the countryside because most of the wildflowers have been torn up. You know, we've lost 95% of our meadows in this country. We've lost so many areas. Does anybody know where they can see a pond, a wild pond in their neighbourhood where you could go and, you know, look for sticklebacks or frogs or newts? I don't. Anywhere around Sherborne, I have no idea where I could find a pond, but I can find three in my garden.
So you've got a patch of land here where you can actually do something personally and are doing something.
Yes, I am. But it does, I mean, I'm lucky I have nearly a third of an acre, which is fantastic, keeps me busy. But you don't need to have that. You can have very small bits of garden. But those small gardens are part of perhaps a huge housing estate. If you add all those gardens together, that is in effect the jigsaw of a nature reserve. If you provide some places for the insects, the dragonflies, the butterflies, the bees, the whatever it is, the birds, they will come and they will fly from garden to garden to garden because they don't recognize the boundaries. So you may think that your tiny garden can't make a contribution, but in fact it can make a massive contribution if everybody does just a little bit.
This is the sort of thing that is very encouraging for people to hear, because one tends to think, well, what can I do? I'm completely hopeless, you know. But if you've got a garden, if you're lucky enough to have a garden, you can still do something. Even if you've got, as Mike Burks of the Gardens Group keeps telling me, even if you've just got a flower pot outside or a balcony with a pot plant on it, that will attract the insects.
It is. It will. And most people will have heard the term rewilding these days. And it to some extent, it's got a bit of a bad reputation, because there are people think, oh, that means that I've got to abandon any kind of gardening or cultivation whatsoever. That's not the truth. It should really be called wilding rather than rewilding. And it doesn't all have to be about wildflowers. It's not everybody has to create a meadow in their garden. In fact, there are many, many cultivated plants, all of which, let's face it, have been derived from wild plants originally, so they belong to the same genus. And many of those plants are the food plants of butterflies and moths, etc. You know, did anybody know that fuchsias are the food plant of elephant hawk moth? Or that honesty will be happily laid upon by orange tips in the springtime. Orange tips prefer hedge garlic, but if they can't find it, honesty will do.
So you decided then, you moved here to Sherborne a few years ago, and you decided you wanted to do something beyond what you can do personally in your third of an acre.
Yeah, because I kept meeting people from different groups. I mean, there are lots of fantastic conservation groups and green groups and environmental groups in Sherborne. And I was frustrated. They're all frustrated because they want to get their message out. They want to get more recruits, you know, they're like evangelists. The hedgehog people want everybody to do something for the hedgehogs. The swift people want people to put swift boxes up. They're not getting their message out. And I thought, well, why aren't we all working together? If we all work together, we can form the equivalent of the Dorset Wildlife Trust for Sherborne. And so what we need is a group where they can all come together under one roof and say, well, we're the hedgehog people, we'd like everybody to do this, this, this in their garden. And then everybody else, who no doubt are in tune with that kind of thing, will go, well, I've never done it in my garden, but yeah, I could do that. It would then take me 5 minutes to make a little hole under the hedge or a hole under the fence to allow the hedgehogs to move from garden to garden. Well, if that's all it takes, then I'll do it.
So Wild Sherborne you envisage as an umbrella organisation,
effectively. Exactly that. It is exactly that, an umbrella organisation. We're not there to tell people what to do. We're there to invite them to tell us what they want us to do.
Right, so getting everybody to work together, which is what I have always thought conservation groups should be doing.
Yes, they should.
But so frequently, everybody just has their own patch.
My experience of lots of wildlife trusts is that they're very... they keep things close to their chest.
Territorial?
Territorial, it would be a good description of them, yeah. I'm not going to be critical of them, they all have their own thing, but they often vie with each other rather than work together.
So, Neil, how are you, in sort of practical terms, what does this mean? Are you going to have a premises? Are you going to hold regular meetings? What's going to happen?
Well, we're working towards, at the moment, a meeting which will take place in late September, which, for the moment, is not available to the general public. It's available for representatives of all those groups I just mentioned, who I'm trying to contact at the moment. So if anybody's listening and I haven't contacted them, and they're from Sherborne, and they're in a kind of a green and environmental group, please do get in touch with me. Just write to wild.sherborne@gmail.com. I'll say that again, wild.sherborne@gmail.com, and I'll happily reply to them and give them an invitation. Once we've had that first meeting, then I hope we'll be meeting once a month. And very fortunately, the gardens group have offered to lend us the butterfly house. So maybe once a month we'll be holding meetings, and people will come and say, this is what we're doing, this is what we want to do. How can we advance this?
And then hopefully, if all these groups decide that they have lots of stuff in common, they will then, therefore, of course, wield a lot more influence, won't they?
That is also my clandestine hope, because as individual groups, we can be ignored. But if we can stand up and say, well, you know what, Wild Sherborne stands for, I don't know, 25 groups. Those 25 groups have X thousand members. It's harder to ignore them.
Especially if they are all taxpayers and voters.
Well, yes, and you know, Sherborne Town Council wears a green hat. It has a very strong green agenda. It says it wants to do green things, and it's won awards. Well, fine, the door is open, we just need to kick it a bit wider.
Where do you see yourself being in a year's time, say?
Ooh, dear, that's a big question, isn't it? I'm hoping that in a year's time we'll have brought together all of those groups, that they'll all want to be part of Wild Sherborne. I will be hoping that we will have a number of projects on the go, which we will be pushing very publicly. One person has already said to me, why haven't we got any riverside walks in Sherborne? You can't. Well, there is one riverside walk, which is in the Purlieu.
In the Purlieu field, but that's the only one.
Yeah,
that
it's
I can
the only one. It's the only one, yes. Another person said to me, why can't I swim? Why can't I do any wild swimming in Cherbourg?
River's a bit low at the moment. Well, and it's not very deep.
It is, but there's no public place where you can say, well, if you're a wild swimmer, that's where you go.
Well, that aside, I mean, are there particular things that you would like to see happen under the aegis of Wild Cherbourg?
Yes. I mean, we need a heck of a lot more trees in Cherbourg. You would say, well, there's loads of trees in Cherbourg. Yes, in people's gardens. In the street, there aren't. It's actually very, I think, it's completely deficient. We have a street in Cherbourg called the Avenues. It's quite a long street. There are 11 trees in the Avenues. 11! There should be 30 or 40 or 50. And we've just had one of the hottest summers ever. And everybody who knows about these things will tell you, you can lower the temperature of the street by 8 degrees by having trees. Well, where are they? And where's the plan to put them in? The minute you start to say, we'll do this, you get councils saying, well, that's going to be a problem. Oh, it's going to be difficult. Oh, who's going to cut them? Oh, for goodness sake, get over it.
So you've got to get the councillor on your side, obviously. Neil, do you see this? So this is Wild Cherbourg that's starting up. Do you see this spreading, this idea, to other neighbouring towns?
Well, actually, I'm just jumping on the bandwagon because there's another group which has started up exactly the same time as me. And would you know it? Honestly, it's a complete coincidence. You wouldn't think it. It's called Wild Yeovil. And they have exactly the same, well, pretty much exactly the same intention as we have, which is to get people to do more in their gardens to encourage wildlife. And if you just go to Google and Google Wild Yeovil, up it will come, and you can get in touch with Caroline, who runs it, and go along to their meetings.
Neil Walker, who's just founded Wild Cherbourg. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Countryside Matters. If you have been, thanks for listening. And thanks to the Gardens Group for its support of this programme. So this is Jenny Devitt saying bye-bye to you.